Today I would like to tell you about collective laser cooling. My co-workers are Adam Black, Hilton Chen, who has graduated from our group, James Thompson, who joined us recently as a postdoc, and the majority of this work was actually performed at Stanford University before we moved to MIT last fall. Before I come to the outline, this is the question that I would like to address in my talk. It's the question whether it is possible to generalize laser cooling to arbitrary light scatterers, to classical atoms. That is, do you need quantum mechanical two-level atoms to do laser cooling, or can you do in a more general setting? Also, is there any non-trivial way to generalize laser cooling to n-atom samples, and possibly to other objects? As you may know, and I will remind you in a moment, laser cooling requires atoms of a relatively very, very simple quantum mechanical level structure. And that has restricted laser cooling to very few atoms, essentially the alkalis, a few earth alkalis, and in particular, no molecules have been laser cooled, and the majority of atoms from the periodic table have not been laser cooled. So as I said before, I would like to ask, are there laser cooling methods that will be largely independent of the atomic level structure? This is what I would like to call classical cooling of classical atoms. Is it possible to cool classical light scatterers? And as soon as you ask that question, you may wonder, well, how is it possible to break the symmetry that will usually exist between cooling and heating particles? If you're not using the atomic level structure, what can you use to achieve that? Come back to that in a moment, but if an atom scatters a photon, there will be momentum transfer associated onto the atom. And depending on the momentum, the direction of the momentum transfer relative to the velocity of the atom, that can either increase or decrease the atom's kinetic energy, right? So in principle, these events will be more or less symmetric with actually a little bit of extra heating, right? So somehow you have to select in some way those events that will reduce the atomic momentum rather than increase it. Mm-hmm. And this is the symmetry between cooling.
How do you define classical atoms in contrast to quantum?
So what I define classical atoms where we only need to use the polarizability of the atom. So we don't need to use the fact where its quantum mechanical levels are.
I see. Position of electronic.
Is not necessary. We just need the particle to scatter light, like a polarizable Lorentz model of an electron would. Mm-hmm. The other fact is that all known laser cooling methods are based on single atom forces, by which I mean that if we have a sample of n atoms to be laser cooled, we can understand what is happening to the sample by just considering what a single atom does in the incident light, how the single atom behaves in the incident light. This also means in practice that all laser cooling methods deteriorate as the number of atoms n in the sample is increased, simply because of rescattering of light, because of absorption of the incident light, etc. And I would like to ask whether there's the possibility to have collective forces. By collective forces, I mean such forces where the force on the atom will depend on the presence of the other atoms in a non-trivial way, in particular such that the force on a single atom is proportional to the number of other atoms inside the sample, or equivalently, the force of the sample scales not as n, but as n squared. So this sets kind of the background of our work. The talk consists of three parts. In the first one, I would like to give you a slightly different view on how you can look at laser cooling. Rather than looking at the details, I propose to look at the emission spectrum from the atom and derive a relation, or argue that there is a relation, simple relation between the emission spectrum and laser cooling. Then the major part of my talk is our experimental results on cavity-induced forces for classical atoms. In particular, we observe a self-organization of the atoms, or I should rather say of the atoms and the light, in such a way that breaks symmetry or translational symmetry due to the presence of the cavity. And associated with this self-organization of the atoms and the light, we observe very large forces on the atomic sample, which scale, which increase as the number of atoms in the sample is increased. And then I would like to give you an outlook how we hope that we can apply this in the future to molecules or new particles. So, as I said, laser cooling has been a very important result in atomic physics. It has enabled Bose-Einstein condensation and all the beautiful experiments and theory that have resulted from this field. And also many precision experiments profit from laser cooling. And in particular, there are precision experiments of molecules that could greatly be enhanced if laser cooling for molecules was available. But as I said before, only few atomic species can be laser cooled. Let me remind you very briefly why that is so. You probably all know conventional Doppler cooling. What we have is a two-level atom. We have two incident light beams, red-detuned relative to the atomic transition by an amount delta on the order of the Doppler effect of the moving atom. And then, of course, what happens is if the atom moves, say, to the right here, then it sees the counterpropagating beam shifted into resonance, the copropagating beam number one shifted out of resonance, so there will be more scattering from the counterpropagating beam into free space than from the copropagating beam, and the corresponding momentum transfer slows down the atom, cools down the atom, stops it eventually, and this is the laser cooling. And that is also the reason why it doesn't work with atoms or molecules with multi-level internal structure. So as soon as you have, say, multiple internal ground states and molecules, these can be vibrational or rotational levels or more complicated atoms, other levels, then if you have an incident light detuned by the Doppler effect, by an amount on the order of the Doppler effect relative to some transition, then after a few cycles, there will be a Raman scattering of a photon that so that the atom ends up in a different internal ground state. And this one, in this state, the atom will be typically far detuned relative to the incident light, certainly not by an amount on the order of the Doppler effect, and the cooling will just stop. So how could you possibly hope to generalize laser cooling? Well, let's look at the moment for some kind of magic black box where an atomic gas, a sample of an atomic gas is contained in such a way that it's not heated by the walls, but it's localized in space in some way. And let's also assume that we have an incident monochromatic field from the left and from the right. And let's further assume that scattering only happens, that there are no non-radiative transitions where the energy of the photon will be converted completely into some internal excitation of the atom, meaning that for each photon that comes in, we have one photon coming out. So we do allow Raman processes, etc., in the gas, but what we do not allow is non-radiative decay in the sample. Well, if that is the case, if for every photon coming in, a photon comes out, then the condition on laser cooling can be simply written in the following way, that if the average frequency of the light emitted from the sample exceeds the incident light frequency, then simply energy conservation forces the sample to be cooled. Pierre, last time I gave a very similar talk to this, pointed out, well, cooling, we usually think of cooling as being associated with entropy, not with energy conservation. However, if you know nothing about the motion of the sample, and you nevertheless are able to arrange such that the light coming out of the cavity or light coming out of this black box is blue detuned relative to the incident light, you will cool the sample, because in the end, the sample will go from a large velocity spread to a small velocity spread and will be cooled. So you can think of laser cooling as some method which is arranged in such a way that the emitted light is blue detuned on average relative to the incident light. That will be sufficient for laser cooling if you're not using any other knowledge about the atomic motion. So what we propose to do is to replace the black box by a resonator and essentially use the resonator to break the symmetry between cooling and heating. And in a way that I will show you, via the detuning between the incident light and the resonator without making any mention of the quantum mechanical level structure of the atom. So we will use the resonator to enhance the scattering of blue light relative to red light from the atomic sample, and in this way cool the atoms. So let's look at it in slightly more detail in a very simple just momentum and energy conservation analysis. Let's assume that an atom with momentum p scatters a photon from an incident wave characterized by an incident wave vector ki into some direction characterized by a wave vector ks. then we can just write momentum conservation in the scattering process as the momentum of the atom after the scattering event is the momentum of the atom before the scattering event, plus the incident absorbed momentum minus the scattered emitted momentum by the particle. And then if we write the kinetic energy after the scattering event, then we can simply write it as the kinetic energy before the scattering event, plus a term which looks like Ki minus Ks times V. We recognize this as the two-photon Doppler effect. This is the Doppler effect associated with the transferred momentum Ki minus Ks. And then this term can be positive or negative depending on the direction of the transferred momentum Ki minus Ks relative to the atomic velocity. And then there's a quadratic term which is always positive, which is therefore always increasing the atomic motion. This is the so-called recoil heating term. In practice, however, for not too small velocities, this term, this recoil heating term, is negligible compared to this Doppler term. And then energy conservation simply tells you that, well, if this is the energy difference or the change in kinetic energy of the atom, that then the energy must be taken out via the tuning of the photon, of the scattered photon relative to the incident photon. In particular, the frequency shift of the scattered photon relative to the incident photon must then be simply given by minus the Doppler effect minus the recoil heating. This is just energy conservation, the single atom scattering event. So what does this mean? Well, this means simply that if we want the atomic energy change to be negative, meaning that the kinetic energy after the scattering should be smaller than the kinetic energy before the scattering, then the photon coming out should be blue detuned. So we should somehow enhance those scattering events that on average lead to a larger blue photon emission than red photon emission. So in a frequency spectrum picture, we have here the incident light onto a moving atom. We will have two Doppler sidebands. These are shifted by the two-photon Doppler effect, Ki minus Ks. And if we can arrange it in such a way that the blue sideband is larger than the red sideband, without using any other knowledge about the atomic motion, we will automatically have cooling. And now we are just making use of results well known from Weisskopf-Wigner theory or just Fermi's golden rule or experiments on spontaneous emission, namely that we can change in a frequency-dependent way the spontaneous emission by an atom by placing it inside a cavity that changes the density of electromagnetic modes in a frequency-dependent way. So in particular, if we can arrange, if we can arrange for the density of electromagnetic modes to be peaked near the blue sideband, which means the cavity resonance is peaked near the blue sideband, then we expect a larger scattering rate on the blue than on the red sideband, and therefore cooling of the atomic sample. Please note that this only says something about the density of the electromagnetic modes relative to the incident light field, namely that this peaked on the blue of the incident light field. Nowhere have we used the fact of what the atomic level structure is. So in particular, this cooling should work for atoms with a simple level structure, for particles with a more complicated level structure, such as molecules, but even for particles with no level structure at all that scatter light. So even in principle, if you had arranged for electrons to scatter photons, or classical glass sphere for that matter, inside such a cavity, you would expect a cooling effect. So this is a single atom picture. What do I mean by collective forces? Well, again, in this picture of the emission spectrum, usually for a sample scattering light, the power emitted on the sideband, the power scattered will be proportional to the number of atoms inside the sample. Okay, this is just the simple picture where we have scattering cross sections, etc. However, we know of instances where the total power emitted by the sample does not go as the atom number n, but rather as the atom number n squared, where the atoms in some cooperative way, the electric fields phase up in such a way so as to emit more light from the sample. So for instance, one example is laser emission, where we use some form of inversion between internal states, between an excited and a ground state, say, to free up the phase of the emitted light field in order to have collective emission. We have also some other instances where maybe the inversion is less obvious, such as Bragg scattering. So if you have an ordered sample if you have an ordered gas, you can have emission that goes as n squared, as the number of atoms in the sample, for gas, we can actually view this, and I'll come back to that a little bit later, as some form of hidden inversion, which is hidden in the momentum classes of the particle. Or rather, it is a coherent superposition of momentum states, and very much the way that superradiants works, or in somewhat the way that Pierre was telling you about yesterday when he talked about the fermions sketching off each other. So basically, we would like to have a situation where the blue sideband is enhanced, and preferably in such a way that the blue sideband is collectively enhanced and that the power emitted goes as n squared rather than as n. So before I come to the experiment, I need to introduce one parameter to characterize this. And I would like to call this the cavity to free space scattering ratio. So we define a dimensionless number, which is simply the rate of photon emission by a single atom or by a sample into the cavity relative to the emission into 4 pi, into all of free space. This is going to be our parameter. For specialists among you in cavity QED, this is the so-called cooperativity parameter. And I'll show the expression in a moment. Now, how large is this? Well, you can very simply argue that the probability for a single atom to emit into the cavity will be proportional to the solid angle subtended by the cavity mode, the solid angle in the far field. That solid angle, by the way, goes as 1 over the waist squared. The smaller the waist, the larger the solid angle. And it will be proportional to the finesse of the cavity. In fact, the finesse over pi, which characterizes the number of round trips of a photon inside the cavity. So this will be simply a product of solid angle subtended by the cavity mode times cavity finesse. And because the solid angle scales as 1 over the waist squared, you can write it also as 1 over mode area, and the finesse scales as 1 over mirror loss. So the better the finesse of the cavity, the larger eta will be, and the smaller the waist size, the larger it will be as well. And as I said, for the specialist, usually the cooperativity parameter is defined, this eta is defined in terms of the single photon Rabi frequency of an atom inside the cavity G squared divided by the cavity line width and gamma, the atomic line width. However, I would like to stress that this is really a parameter that is purely geometrical. It has only to do with the cavity and nothing at all with the atomic line width. This form doesn't really show it because the single photon Rabi frequency also depends on the atomic line width. It's really geometry determined by the cavity alone. And usually in cavity QED, we talk about the weak or strong coupling regime. The weak coupling regime is where eta is smaller than 1, meaning where the photon is more likely to be emitted into free space than into the cavity, and eta larger than 1 is the opposite limit that can lead to coherent Rabi oscillations, exchange of excitation between the atom and the energy and the cavity. And we work here in the weak single atom coupling limit. So it's really kind of a classical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would expect that in the strong coupling regime, the cooling should stop working at some point, right? Because you will reabsorb photons that you have spontaneously emitted. So is there an optimum regime where you want to be?
So you're right. If a single atom was concerned, let's think of a single atom first, you would reabsorb the photon and emit it again into the cavity. However, light would still be leaking out of the cavity. So you would still have cooling, although the rate would not be the simple rate that you predict, but it would be limited now by the cavity decay. So in that sense, it would be better to make the cavity more transmissive, not so good, to get more cooling or a larger cooling rate.
So is there an optimum? There must be somewhere.
Right.
I thought the bosonic enhancement would favor if you have a sample, large number of atoms, then it was proportional to the number of atoms in the cavity, right? Then the more atoms you have, also, then you will emit more photon, and then you could have more booty tuning.
So for more atoms, I agree. I think Pierre was just thinking of for fixed atom number as you increase the... Yes, certainly the cooling rate will go down as your finesse of the cavity gets very good because it takes longer and longer for the photon.
And it also goes down if it becomes very bad, so...
Right, so the optimum is kind of near eta equals 1 somewhere, right, where you basically each photon that you scatter into the cavity, so it contributes to your cooling, but then it leaves the cavity fast enough.
I thought the question was whether the cooling rate on a single atom would be in any quantum physical function way modified by the presence of all the other atoms?
Yes, I think Pierre just asked about the cavity quality. There are some subtleties here because after scattering the atom basically emitting one photon into the cavity, it can in principle make another step in momentum space and emit another photon into the cavity in a stimulated way. So one has to be a little bit careful. One has to then consider line widths, is it possible, and so on. But it's a very good question. I don't know the full answer to that. And the other thing that we are working on in order to be in a simple atomic regime is we work at large light atom detunings. Large for us means a few gigahertz, which is large compared to the atomic hyperfine structure. So our atoms are multi-level atoms, and it turns out that at small detunings, very complicated things happen because you have the possibility of having Raman inversion between different ground states of the atom and other competing mechanisms. So we work in this detuning where we can really think of the atom, all states of multi-level states of the atoms are equally populated, and we can really think of these as classical atoms that are basically always in their ground states. And we can think of them as having a single ground state. And as I said before, we are in this weak single atom coupling limit. The experimental setup to observe these forces that we choose is the following. We use a vertically oriented cavity and laser beams from the side, as I've shown before, and then we prepare atomic samples at different velocities simply by cooling them and then dropping them along the cavity axis. So if you want, this is a way to make a pulsed beam of atoms with a defined velocity. The reason why we chose this setup is in order to distinguish very clearly any cavity-induced forces from any classical laser forces. So all other known laser cooling forces are along the direction of the incident photon momentum and therefore are along the incident beams. So any forces that we see along this direction are cavity-induced because they're transverse to that. How do we look for forces on the falling atoms? Well, we can either image the atomic cloud at different times and verify their motion. I'll show you a picture later, how it expands or how it falls. We have also a time of flight region here where the atoms fluoresce. It's a kind of thin light sheet where the atoms fluoresce as they arrive. So in particular, for instance, if the atoms are falling and then we apply a force and the atoms are stopped, they have to accelerate again. So this means it will take them longer to arrive in the time of flight region. So the arrival of the atoms in the time of flight region tells us something about their center of mass motion in a very simple way. Similarly, if the atoms are cooled, if their temperature is changed, then the width of the distribution as the atoms arrive in the time of flight region will be changed. So if they are cooled, the distribution and time as they fall through this region will be narrower. So this is the way we observe the atoms. As I said before, the cooling efficiency depends only on this parameter eta, which really depends only on the far field solid angle subtended by the cavity mode. That is the reason why we can use a big resonator. Some of you who may know Jeff Kimball's experiments with high finesse cavities know that he goes to very, very short cavities. However, in our model, there's no real need for that because everything is determined by the geometry of the cavity mode, not the actual geometry of the cavity itself. It's only the mode that matters and the finesse. So in particular, if you keep the waves the same and the mirrors the same and just choose a different spacing with the same mirror reflectivity, you will have the same cooling efficiency as long as the Gaussian mode is unchanged. This is what the experiment looks like. This is a distance 7.5 centimeters with two cavity mirrors, one of them mounted on a piezo crystal so that we can tune or stabilize the cavity length. The atoms are prepared somewhere here and then dropped along the cavity axis. The beams come in from this direction and the time of flight region is somewhere here. And we can also, by a photodiode located below, we can look at the light emitted by the atoms into the cavity. And so we set up this
You want the solid angle to be large, is that right?
Right.
So actually the bigger the cavity, better.
Right, so the solid angle is large. However, we would like also the cooling volume to be large. And these are conflicting goals because it goes as 1 over v squared. In fact, what this is, it's not a single mode cavity. It's a near confocal cavity where we're using many transverse modes to make a larger cooling volume than we would get otherwise. But you're right. But in fact, the solid angle here on the mirror, due to spheric aberration from the mirrors, the area is only about 1 millimeter, so it's still much smaller than the mirror itself. having to do with the spherical mirror substrate. So we are really using only in these experiments a solid angle of about 10 to minus 4 or so, and a mirror finesse, a cavity finesse of about 1,000, which results in about 5% photon scattering into the cavity for a single atom. And when we drop the atoms, we see these pictures. These are false color pictures. Essentially, the colors tells you the density of the atomic sample as viewed from the side.
What atom do you
use? This is cesium here. So this picture shows you. Oh, I see. Okay, so this picture shows you with no light applied. The atoms are dropped at zero time. This shows you a picture after 20 and after 40 milliseconds. What you simply see is a falling cloud under the influence of gravity and simultaneously expanding due to the finite temperature of the cloud. If we apply the cooling light a few milliseconds before this picture is taken, then what you see here is that the atomic cloud is already a little bit delayed relative to this cloud. And you see the effect is much larger here. So from this, we can calculate that the velocity, the center of mass velocity of the cloud has actually changed substantially. The light was here applied for 4 milliseconds. Simultaneously, you can also see that the cloud expands less. So the density is higher, meaning that the temperature of the cloud is lower, the expansion rate of the cloud is lower. So when we took these pictures, we were very happy. All seemed to make sense. We found, for instance, that the cooling worked only if the resonator was closed attuned to the incident light frequency. So it was really the resonator to light attuning that matters. We found that the tuning of the incident light relative to atomic resonances did not matter substantially. It was very uncritical, again, something that we expected. We find this force that acts perpendicular to the incident light, so it must be a cavity-induced force in some way. And we find that the force is dissipative, meaning no matter what the initial velocity of the atomic cloud will always, the velocity will always be reduced to zero. So it's a true friction force, in some sense, going as minus alpha V.
Your final temperature has got to be the recording temperature, right, in this case?
The limit?
The limit, yeah.
Yes, the limit is on the order of the recoil temperature, basically because of the quantization of the momentum. Everything that I've talked about is just a very semi-classical result. But you can calculate that because of the presence of this last recoil heating term, the final temperature. In fact, I didn't tell you this, you can calculate the final temperature that you expect for single atoms, and you find it to be on the order of the so-called Doppler temperature, but of the cavity line width. The usual Doppler temperature is the one where the atomic energy equals the, in the correct units, the line width of the excited state. And here the expected limit for single atoms is the one where the atomic temperature equals the line width of the cavity. So in principle, if the cavity is narrower, then the atomic line width, the temperatures will be lower. Mm-hmm. That's right. So we observed all this. However, when we looked at it in slightly more detail, we found that it did not make sense. So we saw these strong resonator-induced light forces that cooled the atoms, but we found that the forces were significantly too large. We can simply calculate what the forces should be. They should be the scattering rate into the resonator, and then the distinction between two sidebands, and the observed forces were too large by a factor of maybe between 20 and 100, way too large. Also, I told you that we wanted to use the resonator to distinguish the blue from the red sideband. We wanted the density of electromagnetic modes to peak there to enhance the blue sidebands. However, we found that this cooling existed even where the resonator spectrum was flat, meaning where the enhancement of red and blue sidebands was equal approximately. We need the resonator to enhance the sidebands, but we don't need it apparently to distinguish between the two sidebands, and we still see a cooling force. So that was very surprising too. And finally, we found that way too much light was emitted into the resonator at high intensities, up to a factor of 20,000 or so. It works much, much better. So you see the cooling force works maybe a factor of 20 to 100 better, and the light emission is actually much, much larger than expected for a single atom. So we wondered what this could be, and we thought, well, maybe if we can explain why the atoms emit too much light into the resonator, then it would be natural to explain why the force is large. In principle, if you have more light into the resonator, you have more photon recoil transmitted onto the atom in a given time, and so you could expect the forces to be larger. So the question is then, where is this? We see this kind of laser-like emission, so a plot in a moment with some kind of threshold. So where is this optical gain inside the resonator coming from? right? How can the atoms emit more light into resonance? I should remind you, we are working at low saturation in what are two-level or classical atoms. The atoms are in the ground state. There's no inversion in the system, no inversion between ground and excited states. So how can the possibly atoms in the simple system emit collectively light into the resonator? The light emission into the resonator typically looks like this. What we vary here for a given detuning is the so-called saturation parameter, which is proportional to the intensity of the incident light. And this is the scattering ratio. It's the fraction of light, the measured fraction of light emitted into the cavity relative to the light emitted into all of free space. And so what we see at low saturation, we see approximately this expected single atom limit of about 5% of the light emitted into the cavity. And then beyond a certain threshold, some collective mechanism sets in that takes this scattering ratio up to of order of unity in this case, and in other plots up to a factor of 100 or so. So suddenly a very sharp threshold looking almost like laser emission, or a better analogy is actually super radiance assisted by the cavity. The cavity emission shoots up. And we found that this threshold depended on the tuning and intensity of the incident light only through the saturation parameter. So if you choose a different detuning, the threshold will appear at the same single scattering rate. So the meaning of this word is it's just defined as I over I set, this is the saturation intensity, an atomic property, times gamma over 2 over delta squared, where this is the detuning from atomic resonances. So there are in principle two parameters, the intensity of the incident light and the detuning of from atomic resonances, or equivalently the strength of the atomic polarizability. This is the imaginary part of the atomic polarizability. P is defined in this way. So you can either vary the intensity or you can vary the detuning in such a way. So it depends only, and the scattering rate of photons by an atom is simply given by P times gamma over 2. This is the scattering rate into free space. So this is just a way to say that even though there are two parameters, intensity and detuning, it only depends on the free space scattering rate by the atom where the threshold is. So just to emphasize this, we expected an emission of about 5% into the cavity. We saw emission ratios as large as 300 to 1,000. Just to reiterate, this means that while one photon is emitted into the cavity, into the free space, about 1,000 photons are emitted into the cavity, where the cavity subtends only this 10 to minus 4 tiny, tiny solid angle. This is a real dramatic effect in terms of the emission. And when we talked to various people about what we had observed, two theorists at the University of Innsbruck, Peter Domokosch and Helmut Rich, they had a model that basically numerical simulations for a few atoms inside the cavity. And based on their numerical simulations, they claimed that the following was happening. They said that in their simulations, so you have the cavity and the standing wave inside the cavity, that the atoms, even at finite temperature, self-organize into this density grating that Bragg scatters light into the cavity. Okay, so they self-organize into a periodic pattern, and then this periodic pattern Bragg scatters light with large efficiency into the cavity. However, if that was not enough, if you think about the cavity standing wave, the period of the optical potentials in the standing wave is lambda over 2. Right? So if each lattice site was populated, you would have destructive interference in the Bragg scattering between neighboring lattice sites, and you would never see any collective enhancement. So in their numerical simulations, what happens, the atoms chose either the odd lattice sites, the black ones, or the white lattice site, the blue ones, so even on the odd lattice site, but never both. Okay, and they would self-organize in such a way and then emit light into the cavity. And in 2D, our experiment is actually 2D, they self-organize into this chessboard pattern of either the black squares or the white squares that then leads to constructive interference into the cavity.
So
to make...
Why is the experiment 2D? I thought your experiment
is... Well, we have two beams coming in from the side, which form a standing wave. And the cavity, right? So basically the phase of the light emitted into the cavity depends on the atomic position both along X and along Z. So it's like big long tubes in the third direction, right? The atoms are organized in tubes here.
The beam is coming in this direction.
Yeah, the beam is coming in here. The cavity is along this direction. The atoms organize in tubes. Now, to make this a little bit less magic, I present in such a way that's surprising, why do they organize into the black or the white spheres? Well, what happens is you get a lambda over two lattice for the standing wave alone, and you get a lambda over two lattice period for the incident light field alone. However, when you add the polarizations of the incident light field and the cavity field, you get a lattice that is has a period of lambda, not lambda over two. But the intensity, where the intensity maxima and minima of this lattice are in space, whether they are the black squares or the white squares, depends on the time phase of the light field inside the cavity. If you invert the time phase of the light field inside the cavity by pi, the whole pattern will shift over by lambda over two.
What do you mean by the time phase?
So it's the, if you were to measure the, if you were to beat, and I'll show you what we did in an experiment, if you were to beat the light inside the cavity with the incident light, you can measure its phase.
Right.
Right. And that phase turns out takes on two values, zero or pi, being determined or being correlated to where the atoms are in the cavity.
So this would not work if you did not have a laser which was very well phase stabilized, I imagine, is that right? So is your laser very well?
It's not terribly narrow, but it's a laser, it's a coherent light source.
Right, you don't have to do anything fancy?
No, not anything fancy. It's a standard kind of grating laser, 100 kilohertz line.
I guess this should be a problem that comes up in any optical lattice, right? To have a stable optical lattice.
Right, but the requirements are very weak actually on a lattice because any frequency difference of the laser corresponds to a very long wavelength. So as long as your sample is relatively small, the laser can be broad.
Your actual sample is three-dimensional. Does it mean that actually you have a kind of tubes, one-dimensional tubes?
Exactly.
So if you add the third standing wave, you will have three-dimensional lattice?
Yes, it should be a three-dimensional lattice, yes.
And, so it's a kind of interaction, non-local interaction.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. It's a non-local interaction. Basically, the atoms see the other atoms via the light field that they emit. Our way to think about that is the following. So the incident light makes the atoms spontaneously emit light into the cavity. If some atom emits light into the cavity, which is localized somewhere, right? So this light inside the cavity interfering with the incident light forms a lattice, a periodic potential for the atoms, which now, under the right conditions, makes the other atoms fall into the positive lattice side, into the lattice sides that are binding. So as more atoms fall into the lattice sides, the Bragg scattering gets stronger until all atoms are in the correct lattice sides. And as they emit more and more light, the lattice gets deeper and deeper, so the atoms get localized better and better. Until it's kind of a runaway process where the atoms localizing increase the intracavity light, and the intracavity light intensity growing increases the localization of the atoms, leading to even stronger Bragg scattering. And the process under the appropriate condition only ends when essentially the intracavity intensity becomes comparable to the incident light intensity, and then the reverse process can also happen where you start emitting scattering light from this cavity back into your pump beams.
So actually, in this process, a large reduction of entropy also localizes these things in the blocks. So before it can go everywhere, but now it's very localized.
Right. However, you have to be a little bit careful. If you were just to turn on this lattice adiabatically, you would also get localization, but you would be trading in space for momentum. So as the lattice gets deep, the kinetic energy of the atoms actually increases if there's no cooling. Right. So if you were just to apply an external light field, this would be just...
What is the bichromatic dispersion of the
atom? Sorry?
The bichromatic, because these two standing waves are of the same frequency.
Okay, so if the atoms are stationary, if the atomic sample is not falling, then they are at the same frequency, in fact, or they can be at the same frequency.
Because, I mean, it's very difficult, typically, to have a cavity and to have two polarizations have the same frequency. This is very hard.
Right. Okay, this is only one. I see, the bichromaticity of the cavity. It's one of the frequencies, so I should have drawn this. The polarization of the incident light is like this. It's polarized out of the plane, and so the light scattered into the cavity due to the dipole pattern is in the same way.
Oh.
It's polarized, so we are using only one polarization. You're completely right. We see huge effects from different polarizations, but we're using only one polarization here. Also, our cavity is really very, very broad. It consists of many, many transverse mode lines that are overlapped in frequency. So effectively, we have a very broad spectrum, which is a multimode spectrum.
So to plot okay. in mm-hmm. your experiment how many atoms in each well or each tube that you have?
I would have to. I think that it's between 100 and 1,000 or so. So the whole sample is between 10 to the 7 and 10 to the 8 atoms in these tubes, self-localized. So as I said, this is really a runaway process where both the atoms and the light self-organize, or that was the claim.
The system is essentially dissipating. We cannot look at it as if it's...
Yeah, so we'll come back to that in a moment. If the atoms were stationary, you could maybe think of this as a non-dissipative system where maybe in some way localization is traded in for momentum spread, right? In principle, the point that I want to make, if you were to apply an external light field like this and you make it strong enough, eventually the atoms would also get localized because the free space, the bands of the free space moving atoms would be sucked in and become bound states.
But it will be a absolutely different situation because if we just have standing wave, dejuned, or everything is coherent, we have only on-site interaction and we do not have this checking point.
Right. I agree. So it is...
some essential difference.
There is an essential difference, and we will see that in a moment, what happens when the sample is actually falling inside a cavity, what happens to the experimental system. So we wanted to verify whether this is happening, and so our idea was that we should be able to distinguish between the two lattices by measuring the phase of the light coming out relative to the incident. So for instance, if you compare these two lattice sites, the phase of the light emitted, or these two lattice sites, the phase of the light emitted into the cavity will differ by pi because this distance is lambda over 2. So in principle, the time phase of the light tells you, in at least some relative frame, whether the atoms are in the black lattice sites or in the white lattice sites. So by setting up essentially an interferometer between the light emitted from the cavity and the incident light field, we can measure the phase of the light emitted by the atoms of the strong light field, and the phase of the light tells us which one of the two lattices the atoms are in, at least in a relative sense. So basically, if the atoms switch from one lattice to the other, we should see a phase change of pi in the light emitted from the cavity relative to the incident light. So the spatial pattern, all I want to say, spatial pattern is reflected in the time phase of the light coming from the cavity relative to the incident light field. And so when we set this up and look on a photodiode, this is what we see. Let's look at the lower plot first. So this is the phase of the light coming out of the cavity derived from this heterodyne measurement as a function of time. Okay, and so what we typically see, this is of course a particularly nice spectrum because it has two jumps, is regions of flat phase, where the phase just fluctuates a little bit, accompanied by jumps in the phase of approximately pi in the light, in the phase emitted by the atoms. And simultaneously, this is the intensity of the light emitted from the cavity. We see that during these jumps, there's no or very little intensity emitted from the cavity. This makes sense because in our picture, when the atoms are localized, they can Bragg scatter, but if they go from one lattice to the other, there should be some phase where they are not localized, and therefore the Bragg emission should go down during these periods.
So this says that the transition from one to the other lattice is random. The atoms move around, it's not coherent, just sliding down.
Right. Well, I should say here that we have slightly cheated here. So when we do the experiment as I described before, what we typically see is a constant phase with sometimes very rarely a jump. So what we do here is we apply an additional fluctuating force by applying the Mott light field. And only when we make this force, which basically randomly moves, shakes the atoms a bit sufficiently large, can we see these jumps, for instance, two jumps occurring in a few milliseconds. Because once the atoms are localized, they have this potential that binds them. And there's, unless this potential is very shallow, there's really no reason for them to go from one lattice site into the other. They are self-organized, it's stable. It's only when you apply an additional term, diffusion term, exactly, that will then sometimes lead to self-organization jumps in the other lattice.
Or if you have a small sample, you should see that.
Or if you have a small sample, or if you're very close to the threshold of this mechanism when it happens. Mm-hmm. And so just to show you that this is correct, we did another thing. Basically, we Now, instead of applying one light beam where the atoms remain localized, we apply first light beams, localize the atoms, measure the phase of the emitted light, basically measure whether the atoms are in the white pattern or in the black pattern. Then we turn off the light for a variable time. We let the atomic cloud expand during the dark time, and then we apply a second pulse of the light. If we apply a second pulse immediately, the atoms should go back to the original lattice. So the phase of the light scattered from the cavity should be the same phase as we observed before. If the atoms choose to go, they go out and then they choose randomly to go to the opposite lattice, we should see a phase jump of pi in the light emitted by the cavity, emitted by the atoms on the second pulse relative to the first pulse. However, if there are only these two possibilities for the atoms to self-organize, we should never see a phase difference, say, of 90 degrees between the two pulses, because there are only two possible stable scenarios, which are 0, 180 degrees. And this is indeed what we see. So the black dots is a histogram for 1,000 measurements or so, how many times we see the same phase emitted on the second pulse relative to the first pulse as a function of pump off time, how many times we see the opposite phase, and how many times we see a phase that is 90 degrees out of 90 degrees relative to the incident light. So in an ideal case, this one should be zero. We should never see the 90 degree phase, and we should see very few events. For very short times, we should, with overwhelming probability, go back to the same time phase, to the same self-organization. And this is kind of the diffusion time, if you want, of the atoms to move from an ordered sample to a completely disorganized sample, where it will be random whether the next phase will be 0 or 180 degrees. So this is the diffusion time, and then this is logarithmic time scale. For very long times, essentially, our interferometer drifts. And that is why all probabilities eventually become equal, because we are measuring time phases, or and so path lengths, the drift will matter. But essentially, we see only a two-valued function. We see only two time phases, and we interpret these as being the two possible self-organization scenarios of the atoms inside the lattice. So just to make this maybe, yes?
So may I think of the following picture? So this lattice along the cavity axis direction actually is not a confining lattice of the atom. What it actually is shows a coupling of the atom to the cavity field. Yes. So this is different from the lattices we are talking about in, you know, both condensed atoms, where we generate a conservative potential. Here, this along the cavity axis, it's really the coupling. Mm-hmm. See, once the atoms move, shift away from those points, their coupling to the cavity began to very weak, so they are. That's why they are self-organized.
Yeah. Right, that's why it's self-organized. However, once the self-organization process sets in, there's really a classical field inside the cavity. We can measure its phase. Their prediction should be a normal Poissonian, like a laser field. And then it starts to resemble. But you're completely right. For the first period, it's really the spatial-dependent cavity atom coupling. I'll come back to that in a moment. That's a very good point of looking at it. So the thing that I would like to stress is the following. So when we are in this limit of weak atom excitation, the atoms, what they are really doing is they are really scattering light, which means the in our quantum optics language that the frequency of the light is exactly, for a stationary atom, is exactly the same as the incident light frequency. So it's not kind of broadened by the atomic resonance, it's a delta function. And for a single atom, we can define this coherent scattering and we find the scattered intensity. Now for an n-atom sample, these atoms, each one scatters coherently light with a phase in a given direction depending on its position relative to the incident and the scattered light. So the way we should think about it is that the light emission from all these atoms interferes. Okay? It interferes, of course, because the atoms are randomly distributed in such a way that it almost cancels out to zero. However, there are random fluctuations in the gas which lead to square root of n fluctuations in the emitted light field, which then leads to a emitted intensity that scales as the atom number. So rather than thinking of the atoms as scattering cross sections, the atoms really coherently scatter fields, and we have to add up the fields first and then to calculate the scattered intensity. And so, for instance, if an atomic density grating develops, that is a situation where the light fields are no longer ruled by the square root of n fluctuations of the phase, but actually all phase up. Then you add up coherently all the fields and you get this n square behavior for the emitted intensity. So it's really the step going from here to there. I would like to point out that this is still, even for a randomly emitted sample, it's coherent scattering in the sense that the electric fields have a well or we can think of them as having a well-defined phase and adding up to give the total emitted intensity. Now, to the interesting point, what happens? This so far was for a stationary sample. They self-organize, they emit light. What happens when we have a moving sample? So we drop the atoms, we apply the light field, and we look at the emitted light field with a photodiode. Now we no longer heterodyne it with the incident light field, we just look directly at what the falling sample emits. And what we see is this in time. Okay? So we see the onset of emission and then a very fast modulation, and you may be able to see that the frequency of the modulation actually changes. And when we compare this to our falling atoms, we find that the frequency of the modulation is at 2 times the Doppler effect. When we change the atomic velocity, we see this frequency change in the correct way. So basically what you see here is the Doppler effect of the atomic cloud changing. And simultaneously what we see, the time of light spectrum, this would be the arrival of the atomic cloud without any light applied. We see a substantial fraction, maybe 1/3 of the atoms or so, being delayed by these forces from the side. So the atomic center of mass motion is slowed, and in fact we find that the atoms are stopped here. So how do we think about this? One way to think about this emission is the following. The atom is falling down, so as it emits downward, it emits a blue-shifted photon by the Doppler effect, upward a red-shifted photon. The red-shifted photon gets reflected on the mirror and is superimposed with the blue-shifted photon. So what we see on a photodiode is the beat note between the red-shifted sideband and the blue-shifted sideband, which is at twice the Doppler effect, which is exactly what we see here. And as the atoms are slowed, the velocity of the atoms changes, so the beat note changes until the atoms are stopped. Okay, so why is this happening, right? So first of all, it's kind of surprising that they can still coherently emit. And second, why are they slowed if the cavity is not selecting? I said the cavity resonance is essentially flat over the spectrum. We think that the following is going on. So now coming back to your point of coupling the atoms to the cavity, what we have is a standing wave inside the cavity with nodes and antinodes. And an atom at a node does not couple to the cavity. It cannot emit light into the cavity, because there's no electric field there. An atom at an antinode couples maximally to the cavity. So another way to think of this emission is, as the atom falls along the cavity axis, its emission into the cavity is periodically modulated. At the nodes it cannot emit, at the antinodes it can emit. This distance is lambda over 2, so the modulation frequency is at twice the Doppler effect, 2 kV. So the light emitted is simply due to the amplitude modulation as the atom couples to the cavity or the atomic sample. However,
whether you have just, I would have thought now that you would have two standing waves, one which is Doppler upshifted and one which is Doppler downshifted.
So that is if I choose to think of the emitted light in a free space context.
Right.
What I'm drawing here is simply the mode structure of the standing wave cavity instead. This is not the emitted light.
Okay.
This is just the G
of the
cavity. Right. And so another way to look at it is just to say that the coupling to the cavity is modulated at 2 times the Doppler effect as the atoms fall, and that leads, due to amplitude modulation, to a modulation of the emitted light into the cavity. Why is this useful? Well, there's a second effect. Namely, the atom is also a refractive index. Okay? So again, the atom doesn't couple to the nodes, to the cavity at the nodes, and couples maximum to the cavity at the antinodes. So the atom as a refractive index changes effectively the cavity frequency or the cavity detuning or the cavity length. So the atom modulates the cavity length or the cavity frequency at exactly the same rate, 2 kV, twice the Doppler effect. It doesn't couple to the cavity, couples strongly, doesn't couple strongly. So what we have is simultaneously amplitude modulation of the emitted light and frequency modulation of the emitted light. And so everybody knows, I guess, what happens when you combine amplitude and frequency modulation. Well, you get for single sideband modulation or asymmetric sidebands. So one way to look at it is red and blue side. This is the amplitude modulation picture, phase modulation, the sidebands are 180 degrees out of phase. And now depending on the relative phase between amplitude modulation and frequency modulation, you can get either the blue sideband enhanced or the red sideband enhanced. It turns out when you think about this that the phase between the frequency and the amplitude modulation depends only on the refractive index of the atom, on the sign of the polarizability of the atoms. If the refractive index is larger than 1, you get 1 sign of one side, it enhances one sideband. In the opposite case, you get the opposite side. And in fact, for the red light atom detuning that we always use, we can calculate or find that we always get blue sideband enhancement. If we do the experiment with blue light atom detuning, which should enhance the opposite sideband, we see a very short burst of emission into the cavity, but we see no cooling forces, and the emission stops.
Again, you say
So basically, the amplitude modulation, I don't know whether you can see it, the amplitude, this is the atomic transition, the amplitude modulation doesn't depend on the sign of the detuning. It's always the same. The phase modulation by the atom is due to the refractive index of the atom, so it depends on the sign of the detuning delta. So one sign of the detuning, and in fact, the red light atom detuning, this situation always enhances the blue sideband, and this situation always enhances the red sideband. And in fact, experimentally, in this case, we always see cooling, and in this case, we see no cooling or stopping, which is just a very short burst of coherent emission as the atoms self-organize, and then the atoms kind of diffuse away. So basically, as long as you're red detuned relative to the atomic transition, no matter what the value is of the detuning, you will get this enhancement of blue sideband over red sideband.
So in that sense, it does depend on some internal structure of the atom.
Exactly. It, basically, you
only the gross feature.
Only the very gross feature which breaks the symmetry, yes, exactly. So these forces are very large. Now let's come to things that we hope to apply them for. So, as I said before, our cavity is essentially flat, and the forces that we see, the fairly large forces on the order of maybe 10 to the 4 meters per second squared decelerations or so, are really due only to a fairly small asymmetry between red and blue sidebands, on the order of 1% or so. Essentially, the cavity line in our situation is broad compared to the Doppler effect, and we see these forces. So we hope to have even much larger forces, by a factor 100 or so, by going to the limit where we resolve the sidebands with the cavity. So we expect in this situation, where we have faster moving atoms, which would be anyway the situation where we would want to cool a molecular beam, in this case we expect only the blue sideband to be enhanced by the cavity. So the combination of both effects, we hope, but we have to still see that, would yield forces that are even 100 times larger than we see them now. But I should say that even these forces right now are larger than the Doppler cooling forces that people observe at the same detuning. We have verified the peak acceleration, that it indeed grows with linearly, approximately linear with the emission into the cavity, which makes sense. The more photons are emitted, the larger the forces. And maybe interestingly for the specialists, the usual laser cooling forces saturate essentially because of the limited rate at which you can emit photons by exciting the atom to the excited state, and then it needs to decay down, taking a time of twice the lifetime of the excited state. Here we find that the emission by the atoms, the collective emission, does not saturate. Okay, so this shows the emission of the atoms into the cavity. This would be the limit where a single atom would saturate if we were to saturate it. However, because of this collective effect, we are really working at low saturation, the classical limit. We are weakly exciting the atom, but still, because of the addition of field amplitudes, the emission rate into the cavity is large, and is much larger than permitted in the radiative force limit. So we can have forces collectively that will be much larger than the single atom forces. Right, it's the many
eventually
atoms.
Eventually, would I saturate up to about n?
Yes, exactly. Eventually, it will saturate when we saturate the atom. Okay, I'm almost at the end of my talk. 2 minutes, maybe. So the forces will be very large. The critical parameter is really how to reach threshold in the system. We would like to understand what determines threshold so that we can predict it for a new sample and design the experiment accordingly. You can make a simple model. We believe that threshold is due to this hidden inversion in momentum space. So in a momentum space picture, what happens is if you have a sample of average momentum P naught and a finite temperature, there will be a difference in populations of momentum classes. And you can think of this difference as being an inversion that can generate optical gain just like laser gain. Between an excited and a ground state. The alternative way to look at it is to ask yourself, how deep must the lattice be so that the atoms will actually self-organize at finite temperature? And both approaches give the same result. And the result is that the threshold is determined by a Rayleigh scattering rate of the atom that can be written as the temperature of the atomic cloud in frequency units and goes as 1 over the atom number. and 1 over the single atom scattering into the cavity. So essentially, the colder the temperature, the easier it is to self-organize the atoms, therefore the threshold is lower. And the more atoms there are, the easier it is also to self-organize them. And we have, I will not bore you with this, but we have verified these three experimentally, these relationships, the dependency on temperature, on atom number, and on scattering rate, and they seem to hold up experimentally. And we verified the power law experimentally. So this is the fact that it only scales as the scattering rate at threshold. This is the fact that it seems to go as 1 over n, the threshold in terms of atom number, and this is that it seems to go as linearly in the temperature on the, yes. And so what does this mean for atomic samples? Well, as I said, the scattering rate is roughly this with a numerical preconstant here. So what are the numbers? For instance, if we have a temperature of 1 Kelvin, say a supersonic beam or something, and an atom number of maybe a million, 10 million atoms, 20 million atoms, and an eta of 0.1, which is similar to what we have right now, then you would need only a scattering rate at threshold of 10 to the 4 photons per second, which seems reasonable. And basically, if you have more atoms, if you have a denser beam, the threshold would go down even further. So the numbers are not crazy. The experiment that we have in mind is maybe a supersonic beam of some molecules, which are cold in the moving frame, but move very fast. So this is the temperature in the moving frame, and then have a cavity around it, and choosing a certain resonance to reach threshold and to stop the atomic sample. And because this works at larger tuning, we hope that we can do this stopping inside a magnetic trap, maybe, so that we could then have molecular sample at, you know, half a Kelvin or so trapped inside the magnetic trap.
So, so you say, did I understand from you, you say that what really counts is the temperature in the moving frame, the absolute velocity compared to your potential grading does not matter?
Does not matter, we believe. If you think of it in this momentum, it's in the space picture, it's a little bit harder to see why that is.
Yeah.
In the momentum picture, we think of this as simply super radiance between momentum classes,
right,
very much like what you talk about or what people see in free space. And you see here that this depends really only on the slope of the momentum classes. So, of course, you need to tune your cavity to a different frequency if you change the center of mass velocity. In space, it's very counterintuitive, and we don't have really a good picture when we have this falling grating, right? So you wonder, when the grating is stationary, it's trapped, but when the grating self-organizes and it's falling...
Can you explain your question?
Well, if you think very naively about this, you think that you are going to try to make a grating, which is a bunch of hills, and you think that if your atoms move too fast compared to this hill, they will never get trapped inside. And so intuitively, you might think that it's not just the temperature of the beam, but also its absolute velocity. But it's too naive, I guess, because you say, well, what really counts is the required, it's the inversion in momentum.
In momentum, I think, and this model seems to be holding up. So I think what really happens is, so the atoms is here, they self-organize into this grating, but they have the center of mass velocity, but the self-organization is fast. So they have this grating momentarily that matches up. They emit a lot of light into the cavity, but they keep falling past this grating. So they probably try to expand in some way in the time domain, and then they get self-organized again. So I think in space, I'm not absolutely sure about this, that the picture is that
the grating is initially a moving grating, and then it kind of adjusts its velocity. That's really what it is.
That's really what it is. So there's kind of a friction force on the moving grating relative to the stationary grating between the two.
Changing
Okay, so this is the end of my talk. Thank you for your attention.